CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. No boundaries. Feel alive.
Tended for all Quebecers. We must take extreme measures to curb the pandemic. Only essential services remain open. Gatherings are prohibited. It's forbidden to leave your home between 8 p.m. and 5 a.m. These efforts aim to protect our healthcare workers, seniors, and loved ones. Let's comply with the lockdown and curfew to lower the risk of contracting COVID-19, because our health is important. For more information, visit quebec.ca/confinement. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
From Turtle Island to Palestine, occupation is a crime. Free, free Palestine! You're listening to Radio Free Palestine.
Welcome everyone, you are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Stay tuned.
United States, a federal appeals court has thrown out an Arkansas state law prohibiting government contractors from participating in boycotts of Israel, ruling it violates their First Amendment rights. In a statement celebrating the ruling, CARE said, quote, just as African Americans had the constitutional right to participate in the Montgomery bus boycott, and just as anti-apartheid activists had the constitutional right to boycott South Africa's government, every American has the constitutional right to boycott the Israeli government over its human rights abuses of Palestinians, CARE wrote.
The Electronic Intifada.
The Electronic Intifada.
The Electronic Intifada.
This is the Electronic Intifada podcast.
I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman.
And I'm Asa Winstanley.
Welcome to the Electronic Intifada podcast. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman in California.
And I'm Asa Winstanley in London, bringing on our colleague Ali Abu-Nema. Ali, welcome back to the podcast.
We wanted to have you on to talk about the Biden administration and what the return of the corporate pro-war, pro-Israel Democrats in the White House means for Palestine and Palestinians. Let's get right into it. It's been about 2 weeks since the inauguration, and already we're seeing, you know, the kind of resurgence of neoliberal foreign policy on Biden's, you know, website, and all throughout his campaign. He was always kind of reiterating his staunch support for Israel, denigrating the BDS movement, smearing activists for Palestinian rights as anti-Semites. What's your kind of general take on where we are and what we can expect with Biden?
Well, that's a big question, of course. But the, you know, the big picture, I think, was summed up in the what was billed as the first major foreign policy speech that Biden gave at the State Department this week. There's just a couple of paragraphs that I think really stand out that highlight the kind of thinking that we're going to see from the Biden administration. And he said, this is Biden, "I want the world to hear today, America is back. America is back. Diplomacy is back at the center of our foreign policy." And then he talks about American leadership to meet this moment of advancing authoritarianism, including the growing ambition of China to rival the United States and the determination of Russia to damage and disrupt our democracy. So in just those sentences, you have distilled a couple of central ideas. One is the notion of quote-unquote American leadership. So this unchanged ambition for world domination. Americans may have elected Joe Biden to be their leader, but the world definitely didn't elect the United States to be its leader. But this kind of American exceptionalism that assumes that the U.S. has the natural right to lead the world. And then the targeting of China as a rival. Why should China be a rival? I don't understand why we always have to see other countries as rivals, but that's already baked into the idea. And then the continuation of the totally bogus Russiagate narrative of China trying to damage and disrupt our democracy, this completely evidence-free dogma and orthodoxy that the Democrats and corporate media have been pushing for years, that, you know, Hillary Clinton lost the election not because she couldn't win enough states, but because of Russian memes on Facebook and all that kind of nonsense that is still deeply drilled into the brains of so many Democrats. And then he talks about, you know, this delusional sentence: "We must start with diplomacy rooted in America's most cherished democratic values, defending freedom, championing opportunity, upholding universal rights, respecting the rule of law, and treating every person with dignity," as if that has ever been the case either in the United States domestically or in U.S. foreign policy, where, you know, everyone knows, everyone outside the delusional bubble of American exceptionalism knows that there's no bigger purveyor of war and coups and sanctions and destruction all over the world than the United States. That's what the U.S. is offering the world. And you have this delusional view from Biden, shared by the elites in this country, that the U.S. is not just a force for good, but is seen as a force for good, and that was only damaged in the last few years by Trump. But before that, everyone loved the United States, and they're going to go back to loving it now. And then, you know, there's this sort of huge influx from the think tanks and the defense contractors and the lobby shops and the influence peddling firms back into the administration. You know, people like Antony Blinken, the Secretary of State, who ran an influence peddling shop. The defense secretary, the new defense secretary, Lloyd Austin, who until, what, 2-3 weeks ago was on the board of Raytheon, one of the biggest arms suppliers. And the list goes on and on. So that's kind of the big picture. When you look at the Middle East, there have been some interesting moves, the suspension of arms sales to the UAE and Saudi Arabia, but it remains to be seen if that's just a cosmetic move to make a headline or leads to anything else. And the announcement that the U.S. will end its support for the Saudi-UAE war in Yemen. And we have to see what that translates into action, not forgetting, of course, that that war was started under Obama. That is, the war on Yemen is an Obama-Biden war. So, you know, it's like, what Biden is doing, if he actually follows through on that, is undoing some of the damage that he and Barack Obama did in the first place.
I think that when Joe Biden said America is back, he probably thought that he was being, you know, trying to be Uncle Joe, the reassuring new president. But I think to most of the world, it sounds more like a threat.
Yeah,
yeah, but it is reassuring to some people, and we should think about who it's reassuring to. It's reassuring to, you know, the American vassals in Europe, and you know the other regimes that rely on you know American support and patronage. So you know those words are just like music to the ears of people in the EU and probably even the likes of Boris Johnson. I mean, yes, they like Trump and
yeah,
they got along with Trump, but Trump was a little unpredictable. So there is sort of an element in the world, the sort of outposts of the U.S. empire, who will welcome this kind of language from Biden. But for most of the world, yeah, I think it is objectively speaking a threat, particularly in Latin America, where so far we haven't seen Biden rolling back the brutal sanctions on Venezuela. We haven't seen him yet rescind the additional sanctions that Trump imposed on Cuba. We haven't seen him rescind any of the cruel sanctions imposed by Trump on Iran, which is on top of the Obama sanctions that deprive Iranians of medicine in the middle of a pandemic. So those are all things he could do right away. Of course, we haven't seen him rejoin the Iran nuclear deal that the Obama administration negotiated. And instead, what we've seen already is sort of an attempt to impose additional conditions on Iran, which are outside the JCPOA, the Iran nuclear deal. So that's the big picture before we even get to Palestine.
Yeah, there was I think it was maybe CNN or some other mainstream outlet that attempted to portray Biden's relationship with Israel as kind of like a an awkward kind of like post breakup sort of thing with Netanyahu, where he, you know, Netanyahu was of course a dear friend of Trump, but they tried to make it look like Biden and Netanyahu were somehow opposing forces or on different sides of the, you know, the situation in Palestine, which I thought was, of course, just hysterical, but also like very, you know, plays into that sense of delusion of, you know, liberal corporate Democrats somehow, you know, working in the interest of Palestinians and working in the interest of, this so-called peace process. So let's turn a little bit to Palestine and to Biden's and the Democrats' historical relationship with Israel. What the relationship has been between them and the Netanyahu administration, and where that will go.
The big story of the past 2 years, the big trend that we've seen in the United States and in other Western countries, is that support for Israel has collapsed on the left. And even within the basis of the mainstream sort of center-left parties, which supposedly the Democratic Party is, or what passes for a center-left party in the United States. The same thing has happened in the UK, as Asa knows, of course, from his reporting over the past 5 years. And so how this played out in the UK was that the collapse of support for Israel on the left and even within the Labour Party, remembering, of course, that the Labour Party historically has always been a very pro-Zionist, pro-Israel party. But the collapse of that support for Israel meant that Israel and its lobbies had to wage a war, basically, against the Labour Party, against Jeremy Corbyn, to bring it to heel. And that has effectively happened. Now the Labour Party is under the control of Keir Starmer, who has a self-described Zionist. But that doesn't change the basic dynamic that within the base of the Labour Party or its potential base, there's very strong support for Palestinian rights and very strong opposition to these sorts of policies, which have to be imposed really by brute force from the top. That's what we're seeing in the UK, where any dissenter has to be purged from the, literally purged from the party. And it's a similar dynamic in the United States, but it's harder because we don't have, parties in the United States are different from the UK and from Europe. They're not as centralized. You can't just impose that sort of discipline from, you know, the party's central headquarters. So it's been, you know, sort of a slow war of attrition between the party elites and the party base over the question of Palestine. It's played out particularly over BDS and support for BDS, the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. But the big story in the United States, really, the big picture, has been that the base of the Democratic Party has become much less pro-Israeli and much more supportive of Palestinian rights, whereas in general support for Israel and the US has shifted to the right, to the Republican Party. And but the leadership of the Democratic Party, the Barack Obamas, the Nancy Pelosi's, the Joe Bidens, the Kamala Harris's, the Pete Buttigieg's, their support for Israel remains absolutely solid. And that is what is reflected. And of course, you know, to the extent that there was a shift, I mean, Bernie Sanders, a lot of supporters of Bernie Sanders were much more pro-Palestinian. They pushed Bernie Sanders, although he remains a strongly pro-Israel figure. Sanders, he does not support BDS. He has made some good, some strong statements about Gaza and so on. But what we see now in the Democratic Party is just rolling over all that base support for Palestinian rights. The Democratic Party platform really does not, it's very pro-Israel. It could have been written in the early 90s or even the 1980s. And what we've seen in the first 2 weeks of the Biden administration is top Biden officials, including the Secretary of State, the UN ambassador nominee, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, so the Secretary of State, Tony Blinken, UN ambassador, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, coming out with very strong anti-BDS statements, and Thomas Greenfield actually pledging to use her position at the United Nations to fight BDS. And in one of the more worrying statements, actually, Janet Yellen, the Treasury Secretary, coming out, this was pointed out by Josh Rubner in a piece he wrote for the Electronic Intifada this week, pointing out how Janet Yellen is pledging to use her position as a Treasury Secretary to fight boycotts of Israel. And that's very worrying because the Treasury Department has immense power through the Office of Foreign Assets Control and other mechanisms to harass companies or individuals that are involved in BDS. So we have to see what that translates into. But it's worrying. And what's also worrying is that the State Department has come out and strongly embraced the so-called IHRA definition of anti-Semitism, which, as we know and we've discussed many times, is not about fighting anti-Jewish bigotry, but is about smearing and silencing and censoring support for Palestinian rights and criticism of Israel. So out the door, the Biden administration has reaffirmed strongly pro-Israel policies. It has not reversed key Trump policies, such as the recognition of Jerusalem as Israel's capital, the recognition of settlements as not illegal, and other measures like that. Well, maybe they will, but so far they haven't. And those are things they could have done by now if they were serious about them.
Right. I think even Biden said, that he wasn't interested in moving the embassy back to Tel Aviv, that he was basically, it was just going to kind of roll over into the status quo, into new facts on the ground. Talk a little bit more about the U.S. war on BDS, the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. As Josh Rubner, as you mentioned, he wrote in his piece this week, Anthony Blinken kind of reiterated his and President Biden's, you know, resolute opposition to BDS. And then Blinken went on to claim that the BDS campaign, quote, unfairly and inappropriately singles out Israel and creates a double standard that we do not apply to other countries. Meanwhile, at the same time, we have, you know, 30 U.S. states that have passed anti-BDS measures, some more restrictive than others. We have, you know, the Trump administration's executive order basically deeming the BDS movement as an act of anti-Semitism. Again, incorporating the so-called definition of anti-Semitism, the IHRA. And we see more and more administrations of universities here in the U.S. taking a hard line against Palestinian students who want to organize for Palestinian rights. Can you talk a little bit about how this, how this new era, rehabbed Obama administration in the form of the Biden administration will continue this war, especially against activists, against students, against civil rights defenders, and what that means for the BDS movement
here? Yeah, I'd say the main thing I'm seeing between Trump and Biden on these issues is continuity rather than any kind of break. Just before leaving office, Trump's Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, I think it was, declared the BDS movement to be anti-Semitic. And Biden's UN ambassador, in her confirmation hearing, agreed with the position that the BDS movement is basically anti-Semitic. So no change there. The IHRA definition of anti-Semitism, which was originally adopted by the Obama State Department, doubled down on by Trump, and now Biden confirms that, the Biden administration confirms that they embrace, not only embrace that definition, but will be pushing countries around the world to adopt it. So they're committed to evangelizing for the notion that criticism of Israel and its racist state ideology, Zionism, is the same as hating Jews. And which is, as we've said before, an inherently anti-Semitic idea, the equation of Jews with Israel, which is what this definition actually does under the ostensible cover of fighting anti-Semitism. The only silver lining, you could say, is that Blinken did acknowledge that... the administration will respect First Amendment rights in the context of BDS. But what does that really mean in a context where the most egregious and serious and troubling violations of free speech are not being done by the government? The government is violating free speech rights in many ways, but the ones that affect most people, the ones being done by Silicon Valley companies, by Facebook, by Twitter, by other social media firms, that because they're private, the First Amendment doesn't apply to them, but they are effectively monopolies. We live in a world where the First Amendment doesn't provide enough protection from censorship, because we're speaking through networks right now that are controlled by private companies and that can shut us off anytime they want, as you've reported, as Zoom has done with seminars with Leila Khaled, as Twitter and Facebook have done, as we've reported many times, shutting down the accounts of Palestinian journalists. And more widely now, we see many left-wing independent outlets having their YouTube channels demonetized, having their accounts shut down, and so on. And the government doesn't have to do the censorship itself when the Silicon Valley companies, which many of them work closely with the government, many of them have contracts with the government, are willing to do it themselves. So Blinken's reference to the First Amendment provides a tiny amount of reassurance that they're only willing to go so far, but not very much reassurance given where the bulk of the censorship is being done now.
Perhaps it's just as well a recognition of reality that, you know, a lot of these laws are going to ultimately go to court and be defeated on First Amendment grounds. What do you think about that?
Yeah, and the laws themselves are a nuisance, but they are not really able to suppress free speech. You know, there's no law in any state that, I don't want to minimize the threat that some of them do. The laws that were overturned in Texas, in Arizona, and where else? Nor there was another, Kansas. So there were laws that were overturned because they were clear violations of the First Amendment and clear threats to free speech, and they were overturned. And I think there are others that are threatening to free speech that have not yet been overturned. So I definitely don't want to minimize that. But some of the laws are more of a nuisance, and they're more about sending the message that BDS is bad. They're more about demonizing supporters of Palestinian rights. So even if the government, the federal government, is not going to try to prosecute people for BDS campaigns, the mere fact that top officials are out there demonizing the BDS movement, lying about the BDS movement, falsely accusing it of anti-Semitism, means that they are using their positions of immense influence and power to attack a civil society movement that is about defending human rights and, of course, challenging U.S. support for Israel, which is destroying the lives of so many Palestinians. So they can do damage without going to the extent of prosecuting people.
Right. And it is a message that they're sending. It's also trying to, encourage activists, students, professors to self-censor,
The chilling effect is the biggest effect of all of these laws and all of these policies and all of these statements. It's about scaring people into silence. And what also remains to be seen, because it started under Obama, of course, but under Trump, we saw a whole slew of complaints filed to the Office of Civil Rights of the Department of Education, making completely bogus and spurious accusations of anti-Semitism against various universities for not cracking down essentially on Palestine solidarity campaigns. I think it's right that none of those have really gone anywhere. But none of them resulted in an adjudication saying, yes, this university is guilty of this and must impose these remedies. But those complaints are all about, again, harassment, lawfare, chilling, making university administrators more fearful and more cautious and more ready to preemptively crack down so that professors and students don't get out of line. And so it remains to be seen how aggressive, whether the Biden Department of Education is going to, how aggressive they're going to be with that kind of thing.
Let's move on and talk about a slightly different topic, but another one of Biden's picks for his new top officials. So Anne Neuberger, I think it's pronounced, is a top official at the National Security Agency, and has been for the last 8 years, I believe. And there was quite a good report in Mother Jones about how she has been picked as Biden's top advisor to the National Security Council on cybersecurity. But public information of her charity filings revealed that the charity that she and her husband control donated much higher than $500,000 to AIPAC, the Israel lobby. There's a lot to talk about in this story. I think it's quite shocking in some ways, really, but it's not surprising when you know the history behind all of this, is it?
Yeah, this story is so interesting because it's not just about this glaring fact that a top cybersecurity official donated $500,000 to the lobby for a foreign government. The Mother Jones story, you know, Mother Jones is interesting because there are, a sort of a traditionally left-ish magazine, but in the past few years they went full Russiagate, you know, just absolute Russiagate lunacy. So it's always surprising to see a well-researched, well-written story in Mother Jones these days, sadly. But the article raises, you know, first of all, it's based, the facts it reports are undisputed and undisputable because they're based on public filings that the charity has to make with the IRS. So nobody is disputing the fact that Neuberger and her husband, Yehuda Neuberger, donated $500,000 to the Israel lobby group AIPAC. That's undisputable.
Right,
because,
I actually made out to be $608,000.
Yeah, I mean, whatever it is, it's a large sum of money. You know, I just for ease of reference, we're saying $500,000.
Yeah.
But you know, all of this is carefully documented in the filings that every charity has to file with the Internal Revenue Service. So that's not in dispute. And the Mother Jones article raises very valid questions about Anne Neuberger's neutrality to play this role and appropriateness to play this role, given that even top U.S. officials acknowledge that Israel is a major cybersecurity threat to the United States and has and does spy on the United States. So
right.
There are major questions whose relevance nobody would dispute if, all things being considered, the country in question was not Israel but Russia or China or you name the country. Name the country you want to name.
Can you imagine?
if it had been a top official. Like they donated to a
exactly.
pro-Iranian organization. You know, it would have been called a national security threat. You know, it would have been called
or Venezuela or Cuba.
Yeah.
Right.
Right. All of that is a given. But what happened next is so interesting because this was reported by Mother Jones. It was picked up by NBC, which is a major network, of course. And they reported it as, with the headline, Foundation linked to Biden pick for cybersecurity gave $500,000 to pro-Israel lobby AIPAC. The headline reflects indisputable facts. There was an uproar, and NBC came under intense pressure, and they added this editor's note, after a number of readers raised issues with this article, NBC News conducted a review and has determined that it fell short of our reporting standards. In order to warrant publication, it needed on-the-record quotes from critics rather than anonymous ones.
Why?
Right. The article should have also included more views from those who believe that donations to AIPAC do not represent a conflict. And it did not give Neuberger adequate time to respond to our reporting. NBC News is leaving the article on our website in the interest of full transparency with our readers. So basically, NBC News trashed their own article. And put an editor's note, giving the impression to any reader that this article is suspect and cannot be trusted. But of course, that's not true. None of what NBC is saying disputes the central fact that is being reported, that Ann Neuberger's founder, that Biden appointee Ann Neuberger gave $500,000 to AIPAC along with her husband. They're not disputing that. All they're saying, because that's not based on anonymous sources, that's based on public filings with the Internal Revenue Service. The only thing that on anonymous sources provided were comments on this. Now, go back to the Mother Jones story. Mother Jones, and by the way, the Mother Jones story includes comments from some anonymous sources, but it also includes on-the-record comments from a former CIA official, John Cipher, who said, quote, "It's unwise at best. In her world, when people think of cyber threats, Israel is always there, even if it's an ally. It is surprising that someone in cyber who understands Israeli capabilities would not want to steer clear of these politics." So that's an example of an on-the-record comment about the undisputed facts cited in the Mother Jones magazine. But go back to Mother Jones. They added an update to their article, which is really interesting. They say that they had sent Neuberger a request for comment. They'd given her 2 days to respond, which is plenty. You know, in the world of journalism, that's plenty of time to respond. We typically give people 24 hours, sometimes even less, depending on the story. But, you know, if somebody gives you, you know, if somebody contacts you, you can say, well, actually, I need longer. And typically, they'll give you longer. But they're saying just because she was given 2 days. But they were also promised a comment from the National Security Council. And this is what they say, update. After this article was published, this is Mother Jones, update. After this article was published, Emily Horn, an NSC spokesperson, sent Mother Jones the following statement, quote, "We note that NBC has pulled down their own version of this story, saying it fell short of their reporting standards, and look forward to Mother Jones doing the same." So
they don't deny the facts, but they want the article removed anyway.
Right. Well, first of all, NBC didn't pull down the article, so that's a lie from the Biden administration that NBC pulled down the article. What NBC did do was undermine its own solid reporting, its own undisputed reporting, and then the Biden administration uses that sleazy move by NBC to cast doubt on the Mother Jones story. But they don't actually dispute the facts. They don't say, no, it's not true that she gave $500,000 to AIPAC. They can't say that because it's a lie. She did do it, and it's a matter of public record. And they also go into this whole business about how, you know, unnamed sources, and they say the Mother Jones article cited both named and unnamed sources, and Mother Jones gave Neuberger 2 days to respond to a query about her foundations and AIPAC donations. She did not respond. So she could have responded and said, 2 days isn't enough. Can I have an extra day to compile my answer or whatever? Never did that. Mother Jones also contacted the president of the foundation and he did not respond to repeated requests for comment. Mother Jones stands by our reporting. So what they've done, you know, NBC, for example, and of course the Biden administration and campaign, who have for years promoted the most outlandish Russiagate stories based on nothing. And all of a sudden, when it comes to this story, where the central fact is undisputed, all of a sudden they raise the standards to this sort of impossible level where it's not enough to have undisputed facts based on public filings with the IRS. That doesn't somehow prove the story, but also you have to have, I don't know how many on the record quotes. And the hilarious thing, you have to have people defending it from the perspective of AIPAC. So to me, it's just a story about the complicity of corporate, you know, the NBC journalist, to his credit, did a perfectly good story, but clearly the corporate bosses who are, you know, in the bag for the Biden administration overruled it and trashed his story. And then the Biden administration could use that action by NBC to further trash the story. It just shows how utterly corrupt the mainstream media are. And it also shows the absolute refusal to give real hard scrutiny to Israel and its role in American politics, just as the UK media refuses to look at Israel's role in British politics. The huge story, for example, I don't know if we've talked about that on the podcast yet. I know you've talked about it on other podcasts, but Asa, you should talk about the Israeli spy story in the UK Labour Party, and the refusal of the UK media to discuss it is, I think, similar, if not on a bigger scale.
I was just thinking, as you were talking about how NBC's higher-ups effectively, you know, trash their own story. It reminded me very much of The Guardian, although The Guardian's approach was actually worse because they didn't cover the story at all.
But you should give a summary of the story, right, Asa, just because not everyone will know what it is.
Yeah, so the Labour Party has hired a former Israeli spy to work on its social media, which is the kind of story that I could not have made up and put into a film script because it would have been too outlandish, you know. It really does beg a belief. It's shocking, but not entirely surprising in retrospect. You know, Asaf Kaplan, an Israeli who's been hired for the purposes of quote-unquote social listening, protecting the Labour Party's brand online, essentially, by the sound of it, and doing who knows what else. You know, we know, as you said before, like the Labour Party has been systematically purging critics of Israel. Most recently this week, there's been a series of videos from activists, Jewish members of the Labour Party, who, you know, they're not these radical raging communists. You know, these are quite often Palestine solidarity activists, you know, people who used to be in the Labour Party before it turned into this Blairite monstrosity and then left in the Tony Blair years, and are now being purged on the basis of their criticism of Israel or its racist state ideology, Zionism, or merely for expressing some sort of support for Jeremy Corbyn and Starmer's purge of him. You know, there's all sorts of pretext for this purge. And, you know, some activists were saying this week about how Keir Starmer has purged far more Jews from the Labour Party. You know, and Jeremy Corbyn did not do anything remotely like that. And he didn't even purge his political opponents, which in my view he should have done. But the question does very much remain, what exactly is Asaf Kaplan doing in Keir Starmer's office? He's working for the new leader, relatively new leader of the Labour Party, Keir Starmer, although it's been almost a year now.
And Asaf Kaplan, just to you know, draw attention to this, spent 5 years in Unit 8200, which is the cyber warfare wing of the Israeli military. And in 2014, a group of whistleblowers from Unit 8200 detailed in a letter to The Guardian how they engage in systematic spying on Palestinians, just blanket spying on everything Palestinians do, on their phone calls, whatever, looking for any kind of personal information that can be used to blackmail them, to force them to become collaborators for political persecution. And I'm not, this is the kind of words I'm using are the words that the Unit 8200 veterans use in their, right, letter.
Harassment, blackmail, intimidation, mass surveillance. One of the most shocking details of the whistleblowers' testimonies, which I'd not seen before until I was doing research for this story, was that Unit 8200 used to have a phrase, blood on the headset, which was they would put an X on their headsets every time they'd been involved in the killing and assassination of a Palestinian, you know, presumably a resistance fighter, although we don't know that for sure. But in any case, they were killing Palestinians and they were quite proud of it, some of them, it seems, you know. So, yeah. You know, what was this? And this is who the Labour Party, this is the kind of person the Labour Party just hired. It's shocking
so,
stuff.
So just because I think this is so important. So Asaf Kaplan spent 5 years in Unit 8200, which is far more than the 2 years of compulsory military service in Israel. So this is someone who obviously liked the work and saw it as some, you know, it wasn't forced into it in any way. And
saw it as a way to enrich himself and benefit his career. You know, he boasted about it in his online profile that he was a veteran of Unit 8200.
And he was hired for a position at which the Labour Party advertised at around 43,000 pounds per year, which is, you know, not a bad salary, but it's not, you know, the sort of salary that you would think you'd be, like, if you're trying to hire talent from around the world, you're going to bring someone especially from Israel, which is apparently what they did, because you were able to document that Kaplan seems to have moved or appears to have moved from Israel specifically to take up this moderately paid position in the Labour Party bureaucracy, which just happens to be in the office of the party leader, Keir Starmer. And presumably that in all of the UK, there was nobody who was capable of fulfilling this social media role. It beggars belief. At least raises some very interesting questions. You broke this story. I can attest that it went absolutely crazy in terms of traffic. I have to check, but it's probably one of the stories we've published that had the highest traffic, you know, certainly within the first few days of its publication. It was, you made, with this story, you made the Labour Party trend.
Make Israeli trend with
with the Labour Party. And activists all over the country were saying, what on earth is going on? And so now talk about how much British mainstream media coverage of this story was there?
None. Like, there was exactly nothing. There was some very good media coverage from the left-wing media, from the independent press, which is, you know, sort of burgeoning in this country. You know, websites like the Canary had me on, interviewed me about it. The Morning Star, you know, a venerable communist newspaper, did some good reporting following up on it. And Middle East Eye, you know, did some very good, you know, they found out some extra details, which I was quite appreciative of, where they, according to their sources, people were sort of Labour staffers were running around really worried, walking on eggshells, not sure what was going to happen next. So that was nice to hear.
There was nothing from the BBC, which infamously created that graphic of Jeremy Corbyn wearing a Russian hat, wearing a Russian hat, the Kremlin in the background, which was not in any way prejudicial And how about The Guardian? Because
this is really interesting. And I think I will include this in some of the follow-up reporting I'm going to do next week, hopefully. I did tweet about this, but The Guardian, I was informed by two separate sources now, actually, that a Guardian journalist, you know, like you said, like the NBC reporter who did a competent job, this Guardian journalist wanted to cover the story, thought it was newsworthy, talked around, various activists, did some interviews, and approached the Labour Party for comment. The Labour Party spin doctors then tried to persuade this journalist to abandon the story and said to them that, well, if you're going to do this, I'm going to talk to your editor and I'm going to tell them it's not a story and you shouldn't be covering it. The proof of the pudding is in the eating. The Guardian has yet to publish anything about it. So the story's clearly been quashed by the Guardian. But I mean, I can't say that's a surprise, because the Guardian has acted as really the Praetorian Guard for the fabricated Labour anti-Semitism crisis over the last 6 years. And this extraordinary story really is the logical end result of that. You know, when you've got every single Labour leadership candidate at the beginning of last year to replace Jeremy Corbyn, every single one of them, even the so-called left-wing candidate Rebecca Long-Bailey, condemned Jeremy Corbyn in effect. They condemned his words as anti-Semitic. They all pledged allegiance to Israel. They all said they were either Zionists or supporters of Zionism without qualification. It was, you know, Lisa Nandy, who at the time was supposedly the chair of a group that called itself Labour Friends of Palestine, enthusiastically declared that she was a Zionist, you know. It was a really sickening spectacle, you know, and they really made an example of Corbyn. And this story was really the logical conclusion of that, you know. And I just think it does tell us so much about the malign political culture in this country, really, that and the malign journalistic culture in this country, that this big story, big international story, can just be completely swept under the rug.
And there are, you know, defenders of Kaplan who were trying to say that how could you say he's an Israeli spy? You know, like as though his involvement in Unit 8200 was just like some.
Right. He wasn't a spy. He was just pushing, in an intelligence agency. I literally had a couple of Israelis on Twitter tell me that, you know, in all seriousness, right. You know, I mean, it beggars belief. I mean, who else you can call a spy if not someone who's literally
someone who's working for the spy agency?
Yeah, he was an officer in an intelligence agency. That's literally what he was, the definition of a spy. You know, and I think as well, it's important to note that when we talk about espionage, it's not merely just spying in the sense of, oh well, they're observing what's going on, just social listening. They're taking active measures, you know, they're doing things to make a difference. They want to make a difference in the world, right? They want to target, you know, they have offensive capabilities, intelligence agencies, and Israel's no different in that regard. So of course it was sabotaging Jeremy Corbyn all along, and it was effective. But, you know, we're assured, Ali, by Miriam Adelson and Benjamin Netanyahu that the days of Jonathan Pollard are long in the past. So, you know, surely there's nothing to worry about.
Right. Pollard, of course, being the American naval intelligence agent who was arrested in the 1980s for massive espionage for Israel. He passed on major U.S. secrets to Israel in the middle of the Cold War, which, from what I've read, of course, there's, you know, a lot that's not known, that top U.S. intelligence officials considered Pollard to be probably the most damaging spy from their perspective in U.S. history, because Israel was trading these secrets with the Soviet Union, this is the allegation, in exchange for getting Jews out of the Soviet Union, basically to populate the settlements on Palestinian land. And so Pollard spent more than 30 years in prison for his espionage and was recently just flown to Israel to a hero's welcome on the late Sheldon Adelson and Miriam Adelson's private jet.
I think that's a good place to leave it. I think that obviously we will continue to doggedly cover the machinations of foreign policy and domestic policy of the Biden administration and how it affects free speech here, how it affects the BDS movement globally, and of course how it affects Palestinian human rights on the ground. And that's it for the Electronic Intifada podcast. Thanks to Sharif Zakout, our music maker and production assistant. For news, information, cultural features and reviews, and pointed opinion and analysis, visit us online at electronicintifada.net. On behalf of all of us at the Electronic Intifada, thank you for listening.
Palestinian authorities say Israel's halted the shipment of 2,000 doses of COVID-19 vaccine to the Gaza Strip, where they were due to be administered to frontline medical workers. The besieged territory is home to more than 2 million people, but has yet to receive any vaccine. This comes as Israeli health officials reported a nearly 95% drop in symptomatic coronavirus infections among 600,000 Israelis who received Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine, and 30% of Israeli citizens have received at least one vaccine dose, the highest rate of any major nation. But that figure excludes Palestinians in the occupied territories who remain largely unvaccinated.
So that's it for us for today. You were listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal, and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Until next time, I wish you a free, free Palestine.
Prison Radio Show is a twice-monthly news show on CKUT. The show seeks to confront the invisibility of prisons and prisoner struggles by focusing on the roots of incarceration, policing, and criminalization, and by challenging ideas about what prisons are and who ends up inside. We are dedicated to programming that is directly collaborative with people who are currently incarcerated. With that in mind, we would like to let you know that we have a phone line for prisoners and their outside supporters. In fact, we have two phone lines. You can call us Collect from Bordeaux Prison and Riviere de Prairie Prison by calling 514-876-3748. We also have a number for non-collect calls. That number is 438-337-8423. Feel free to call that number and leave a message for us with news to share on the show or an audio message for your loved ones inside.
If you made a compensation claim for abuse at an Indian residential school, the records of your claim are secure. They will be destroyed in September 2027 unless you choose to keep them or share them. To learn more, call toll-free 1-877-635-2648 or go to myrecordsmychoice.ca.